Valerie Black is an anthropologist and disability studies scholar. She holds a PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, and is currently a postdoctoral scholar at UC San Francisco's Decision Lab. She's published studies on artificial intelligence and job displacement, on the uses of user data, on disability among anthropologists, and on her central research area, the use of artificial intelligence technology in mental health care. The article that brought her work to my attention is The Eugenics Logic Behind Running a Government Like a Startup Under the Trump Administration, which appeared in March on the Disability Visibility Project. Welcome to the Old Mall, Valerie Black.
Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be here and so thankful that you read my work and were interested in it.
Thank you for joining us. Maybe before we get into the meanings of the term eugenics and the ways that that seemingly extreme term is warranted at this time and how it fits with startup culture, maybe we can quickly review some of the many ways the current administration has been cutting resources and supports for public health in general and people with disabilities in particular. How is the current administration treating people with disabilities these days?
Yeah, I know when I was working on writing this draft, it seemed like every day or sometimes during the same day, if I pick it up to work on it, I had to update. I have a little section in the opening where I'm linking some concrete examples of exactly these effects. Each and every day, there's more that I'm aware of, and I'm sure there's far more since I've written it and far more that I'm not even yet aware of. One of the ones that struck me most immediately were the kind of blows to education. A lot of the supports for disabled school children are routed through federal funding and oversight. So there is no replacement queued up. This idea that we'll just let states figure it out for themselves, that's not adequate. What do you think taking away basic support systems for disabled students and just expecting experimentation and we'll trial and error and figure it out, or maybe they don't really need it? This dismissiveness is just damages that we can't even begin to start thinking about, what that's going to ladder up to. It's both the actual incursions and this looming threat and potentiality around cutting basic support services in a lot of different programs in a lot of different ways. But just this general umbrella approach of there's all these people out there who are exploiting the system that we need to root out and stop them from receiving their funding. But that is such a distortion. It's a fiction. And meanwhile, it's not even just the actual cuts to your basic resources that you need for food and shelter and so forth, but it's that looming threat each day that it might be happening, that the axe might be coming down. When you don't have any material resources to survive on and you're just having to live with that looming threat day to day, the real harms of that are already something that a lot of people are living with. I feel inadequate to the task of naming everything. For folks who are interested, please check out the article. I can just barely chip away at what's kind of happening big picture.
Yeah, as you say, there were already long wait times for Social Security disability insurance. There were already cuts to Medicaid, 25 million people having been thrown off in the last year because they couldn't complete the paperwork after the pandemic protections ended. So many things. And one of the things that your article talks about is the logic behind these cuts, that DOGE with its big chainsaw resembles startup logic, and the people who are being harmed by this are indifferently seen as waste.
Yeah, we're seeing this a lot right now and have been throughout American history. I've certainly seen this around the idea of the immigrant, the villain, this is the person to blame for everything supposedly wrong with your life, real problems and totally imagined problems and completely imagined source of blame. And so I think you see this idea of disabled people cheating the system, and it's just so completely unfounded and absurd. And where I really started noticing this idea of looking for wastes and trying to cut and trying to be lean and trying to do things differently and shatter the norms, all of this really immediately plugged into the work that I've done as an anthropologist, as an ethnographer, working in the startup sector, doing participant observation at startups in both Silicon Valley and in Tokyo. So I have thought a lot about what startup logic is and what it looks like, and I've seen it up close. What we're seeing right now struck me as idealizing the person going in and finding these places to cut as if it were just a team of 10, 20 people just waiting for a venture capitalist to come in and fund them. You can't live that way as a society, as a governed people. It's not possible to navigate life with these wonder boys out there finding exactly how to make things more efficient. People who don't understand what life actually entails don't understand what is and isn't efficient.
Tell us a little bit more about what constitutes startup culture and how is that visible in the kinds of things that Doge is doing? And maybe how is that different from sort of ordinary capitalist culture? I mean, productivity is generally valued and the work ethic is generally valued, but this is something beyond those more familiar tropes.
You know, there's a lot of scholarly conversation around this idea of where we're at right now in a Silicon Valley centered capitalism. Is it late stages capitalism? Is it techno feudalism? Is it something that's gone so far around the bend of capitalism that it's back to feudalism, cloud feudalism again? You know, there's a lot of scholars generating a lot of thought about, is there even a difference, or are we just not able to see that it's just the continuity all along and this is just the current manifestation of it? You know, you have a lot of perspectives, a lot of places in the world where it's hard to kind of come up with a unifying theory right now, I guess. So for the scholarly set out there, I just want to flag this is a very open-ended discussion that's in the works. You know, to me, I think just from a very practical sense, I see in my own life and experiences, limited as they might be, you know, I see a difference. I've been in the Bay Area for a long time. I moved up here from Southern California just a couple weeks before President Obama was elected into his first term. So that's how long I've been in Berkeley, California. So I've been here a while and I've seen a lot of transitions. I've seen a lot of spread of ideas that I was noticing belonging to people who I knew who worked in the tech sector and in the startup sector, just watching that bloom and explode and take over and then spread into other industries and sectors is normalized. This is a good way to do business. So just drawing on that, and I think what's interesting too is that the tech sector, of course, is dominated by companies that are in no way startups, but they too idealize this idea of the startup. Either they came from a startup origin, or there's just this underlying fantasy that a startup is just where it's at. That's when you don't have to deal with all these rules and oversight, and you figure it out yourself, and you make it happen the way you want to make it happen. And it's just such a expansionist, Wild West. They always use these metaphors. You'll see them all the time of Wild West. Wow, yeah, so that's colonizing. It is in a very unhidden way, kind of one and the same. So you want to come in, take something that you think is open terrain for you to occupy and turn it into what you think it ought to be, make your own rules. And I think that's sort of the underlying zeitgeist. What stands out to me is the fact that it is so completely reliant on having a safety net from federal funding and state funding. A lot of this experimentation would not be possible without all these centralized resources already being in place. You just pretend that's not the case. It's your world and your terrain, and no one was here before you, and you're just showing up and making it yours. And not only are you having, you know, a group of people that are in denial about what kind of resources that they're depending on, but you also have this sense that you don't have to be beholden to previous solutions, previous mistakes. Mistakes are sort of glorified as just part of the routine, part of the process. That's not to paint every level of experimentation with the same brush. There are a lot of things that I would admire about this, but it's just when it's taken to its full conclusion, it produces really scary outcomes and reasonings. And I think, yeah, the venture capitalist piece of it is probably the biggest claim to a categoric difference, because the thing about the venture capitalism world is they're not intent on ensuring greater thriving of small businesses. That's not what startups are about. Like, you go into it with this understanding that it's going to be a big win for your startup to even last for a few years, let alone to acquire enough funding to the whole unicorn journey of it all. You know, that's not a given. And I think the thrill of the hunt, some people kind of look at it as a, well, you get a couple failures under your belt, and that's where it only, you know, begins to take off. Then you've got your chops and you're ready to try again and this time succeed. And it, there again, this sort of thinking just does not lend itself to taking care of people at scale.
You point out in your article that startup culture is characterized by a culture of expendability, that there's all this crunch and grind, and you work really hard and you sleep under your desk. And then when it all goes belly up, oh, well, try again next time. But you point out that the people who are running these and at the top of them or starting them are not the ones who suffer the expendability. They are not suffering from the collapse. They have social support networks. They have vast pools of wealth themselves. And it's other people who are working in them, who are involved in them, who are suffering the collapse of these many startups.
That's right. And a lot of that process to becoming desirable for hitting that big time window of VC funding, it kind of makes me think a lot of boxers trying to weigh in before a match. So sometimes even this pursuit of cutting everything you can and getting so lean that you look incredibly desirable, with the understanding that, of course, we're going to have to bring this right back in as soon as we have funding. So it's not even the ideal startup's leanness at these critical windows for its survival and growth. They're not really about even living in this idealized balance of we need so little in order to thrive, but it is about showing it to the right person for a window of time and then ditching that too and then doing what you need to. So I think this artifice around efficiency, it's so disturbing to see this rolled out into context where it just makes absolutely no sense and there's just no concern or consideration for what kind of ramifications it has. I don't even mean like years from now, but even like a month from now. There's so little foresight that even a month from now is not being forecasted or considered, seemingly.
Maybe this is the place to turn to the question of eugenics and what eugenics logic might be in this instance. And eugenics, as you say, is a very strong word. It sounds extreme. Is that really what's going on? How does startup culture foster eugenics? Is that really what we're looking at?
Yeah, I think anytime someone hears the word eugenics, they're thinking this is dark history from the past that arguably is now thankfully over and in the past, and we'll never return to that again because now we know better. But, and as I mentioned in my piece, sadly, if you're disabled, you're going to come up against eugenics logic and recognize it as such all the time. All kinds of expectations around who is fit, who is worthy, who should be, quote unquote, reproducing, who is a valuable contributor to society. I think about so much of how we define what disability is in opposition to certain very conventional forms of work and productivity. Certainly in many countries around the world, a lot of times disability is defined as a percentage. If you have multiple disabilities, you might have this plus this puts you at 68% disabled. So there again, it's unabashedly defined in opposition to your work outputs. And so it's pretty quick to see that this idea of who is worthwhile, who's pulling their own weight, who's earning their keep, and then who isn't, it certainly hinges on a lot of other factors besides disability. But this is why I chose to focus primarily on disability, with the understanding, of course, that it is entirely intersectional with many other identities. And I would really encourage anyone that thinks eugenics sounds like a really extreme word to just pause and reflect on what that history was, how it never actually ended. Even some of the worst things that we think of are still happening in some form or other, and many of them very close to home. And certainly with, control over reproductive health and well-being, you see an entire continuity around who is able to make decisions about who should live and who shouldn't. I think the pandemic brought this into view for far more people to start to see, just because so many more people were affected by that there's this ruthless logic of what is a life that's worthy of preserving and having resources allocated to it. All of this understanding of eugenics, of course, is rooted in this complete assumption that care and care resources are inherently, inescapably scarce and limited. So the game begins with who gets what and then who is earning what. And really, that is not necessary for life. That is not a universal, timeless organization of life and how we live and how we treat one another.
Yeah, you point out in the article that some of the tech billionaires behind the scenes are avowedly eugenicist and have fantasies about the future in which they will be running things from their thrones.
Yeah, the IQ piece is that's your first big tell. people are becoming less and less inhibited around espousing open business as usual eugenics. And a lot of folks who are in this aforementioned, Silicon Valley tech bubble, you see it with certainly Elon Musk, but many others as well, around this call for, the right kinds of people to be having babies. And you have a real allegiance to this idea of high IQ being the cherished resource that needs to be promoted into the future. And it's, of course, these folks and their babies that are going to save us all. We're back to an unabashed bent of IQ is something to be enshrined and idolized. So that's kind of the most obvious way that you're going to be seeing this show up in tech worlds and amongst this billionaire class right now.
You point out there's a paradox involved in their calling on both the idea of innate merit and having pulled themselves up by bootstraps in various ways, that it's their hard work and anybody can do it, but also they are special innately.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I believe I called it working class stolen valor because that's Elon Musk to a T, but it's absolutely not just Elon Musk. In fact, something that I have written about but haven't managed to publish yet is really about this backlash against working from home, remote work. I'm someone who has a lot of immunological health issues. So for me, I've been counting on remote work options long before anyone was able to even imagine COVID-19. And a lot of things that were inaccessible suddenly became just really ultra accessible in many ways for me. And that's, not true for everyone. For many people, it's an absolute deal maker. And then you had in this moment so many tech companies forecasting the future. And sure enough, before long, you had the same companies that were like, this is the real future of work, and we're at the forefront of it. They were saying, no, we need people back in the office. It doesn't work unless you're in person together. And I just was really struck by this idea that you have people like, Musk and Bezos who are seemingly wanting to colonize Mars. How do you think that's going to happen if you can't work with someone remotely? I hate to break it to you, but space, it's really remote. So, you better work on those communication chops while you can, friends. For Musk, the thing that really puts it over the top is it's not about this is my personal preference and I'm just going to force that onto everyone I can. He's spoken about it as a moral problem, this idea of, remote work, and he frames it as something that is problematic for all workers. Working class stolen valor yet again, where no, we need to think of the working person who's out there in the factory, and they're going to do that. We need to do that. The laptop class, he calls it, as if anyone needs to be lectured on class politics by a billionaire. Musk isn't saying, yeah, these folks need sick leave. They need these resources that give them flexibility that they can't otherwise have. That's not something that he's arguing for. He's just saying, no, if these folks have to be in person, we'll all be in person, as if somehow the trickle down effects of that will make factory workers feel like better about their circumstances. Just knowing that that office guy's in an office too, it makes no sense.
It makes no sense, except that commercial real estate owners really want people back in their offices and paying the big bucks.
Yeah, I think that is such a huge part of it. I definitely think that's the case. But what I've written about, and again, unfortunately, I haven't been able to publish this yet, but maybe I'll try again, because I think we're kind of seeing this unfold a bit right now with everything that's happening with tariffs. I think some of it's about political holdings in certain locations, not wanting people to say, well, I can't afford to live in Northern California, but on this income, I might be able to move to this state. And it's, a predominantly red state or red area, but I could buy a house here. I think there was a real interest in slowing that. But I think even bigger than that, perhaps, is the fact that our economy is a big old pyramid scheme. And so you have folks who were not only, moving to different states, but you had a lot of people who were going abroad, traveling and maybe moving to other countries, but also people who were just moving temporarily, and they even had terms for this, and it was becoming quite a common practice for a lot of folks. Some folks were even doing it with families with like younger children, and we're going to be in this country for this period of time, and now I can log in and do my job and log out, and then have the rest of the day to make this happen. It's something that otherwise would never be affordable or possible, but because of this technology, I'm able to do it. But I think it really started to sort of push at the pyramid scheme of it all by kind of showing, here you are, if you've chosen to go to the Philippines and work remotely, what do you know? Like, not even a mile away from you, you have digital sweatshop workers who are from offshoring and outsourcing of work and all this masking of Facebook contracts, this company contracts, this company contracts, these laborers who are only paid dollars a day at most to be doing the digital work. And then what do you know? You've got this American worker who, if only by virtue of their passport, they're commanding many, many, many times over the same income. It just starts to get a little too uncomfortably close to the idea that you managed to be in a completely different class depending on the destiny of what country you're born in. And I think that our global elites do not like things that let people notice the pyramid scheme. And I think that's where a lot of the tariff situation is really showing this idea that we're going to bring back all the work that we have outsourced, but it's outsourced because we can get away with treating people around the world.
As though the problem weren't that capitalist owners are simply seeking the cheapest labor.
That's how the system
Yeah.
works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's an instance of the ways that during the beginning years of the pandemic, all sorts of accommodations were made, making things more accessible, fulfilling demands that people with disability had been making for years. And many people found that this worked well for them. They could work from home, they could avoid that commute, whatever. Working from home was just fine and helpful and safer. But now you point out that executive order calling back diversity, equity, and inclusion also adds to that list accessibility, and that there is a kind of perverse intersectionality in the attacks on DEI because it's DEIA.
That's right. Yeah, it's just really darkly gratifying to see that in all of the tyranny, that at least our federal leadership understands the solidarity between all of these as an essential facet of all that DEI and accessibility are. I think anyone who is an advocate of any aspect of DEI and accessibility would absolutely want this solidarity. But it's just really so grim. We're in for some really scary times, depending on what happens in the next few months. Just seeing all this play out, not only because of all the incredible harms to so many people, but how long it takes to claw one's way back to where we were, which was already not good enough.
Yeah. Normal was not good. This is worse.
Exactly.
Do you see opportunities for action, for hope? How do we begin clawing our way back? How do we respond to this?
I love that question. You know, it's so tricky. Normally, I am such an optimist, and I'm struggling a lot right now with what does optimism look like? What am I entitled to feel in terms of optimism? There's so many things I could point to, but just one that crystallizes in my mind is trying to explain to my parents very gently that basically nobody under 40 right now expects good things to happen ever again. And so I want to be very real with everyone and very sensitive to a lot of positions that are dealing with a lot worse than what I can even thoroughly imagine right now. So maybe it's less about finding optimism and more about just determination and keep doing something. And it doesn't need to be because you believe things will end up a certain way. And I certainly am inspired by seeing so many people keep on doing what they're doing. And I think just speaking up, looking at what consequences you might face and negotiating, what can I take on? What could I strategize and work with someone else that they might be able to take on? And doing what you can. I mean, I think that's kind of my approach to life in general, just a day by day doing what you can. Sometimes that's enough. And sometimes a bigger vision just isn't always possible to sustain, and that's okay. Maybe we'll get back to that. It's interesting because I think as an anthropologist, so much of what anthropology is about is being able to see the gap between how things are and how they could be, being able to see what's not inevitable about how things are. And I think for many, that's a sort of inherently optimistic position that you can see this is how things could change. But it's hard to get out of the pessimism of it, though, of there's always so many things that don't have to be the way they are, and yet they keep playing out in this way. So that's probably not a very uplifting way forward, but I'm continuing to look for folks that are finding those ways. That's what what I see is what I need to be doing.
So people continuing to work together to envision a more accessible, a more caring world, to continue doggedly doing the organizing, the mutual aid, the envisioning, the art, the collective actions that we can, as we have been, to keep pushing forward.
Collective action is it. Yeah, I don't think that there's any other way that positive change is realized. And sometimes what collective action looks like can differ for different people. And I think if someone listening to this feels like, I want to take part in these actions, I can't go to these marches because it's really hard on my body. It's really hard for me to do this. A piece that I think was written, I want to say, in 2016. The scholar's family name is Hedva, Hedva, and it's a piece about what showing up looks like, what participating in collective action looks like, particularly through a disability framework, but not solely that by any means. Just this idea that you don't have to physically be in the streets to be an active, vital part of collective action. So I think, yeah, if anyone feels like it's hard to find those next steps, just starting in different ways is still part of that bigger fabric. And I think that's something I would encourage anyone to remember.
So getting involved with groups online, creating art that can be shared, sharing information about actions that other people can take, all kinds of things are accessible.
Absolutely. You can reimagine what collective action looks like and do that. If something occurs to you as this is something that could be of help, this is something that can make any scale of difference, instead of thinking it has to look or be a certain way, meet a certain threshold of difference making in order to be worthy of execution, I don't think that's it at all. I think, honestly, even just staying in dialogue and having conversations with people in your life and bringing them in, just staying attuned, I think there's a de-gaslighting process that needs to happen each day. Are you seeing this? This is not okay. Because a lot of people, particularly in many positions of power, are very much doing the head in the sand thing, where either not acknowledging what's happening or not acknowledging the magnitude of it. And I think insisting on that acknowledgement is already part of what collective action is to me.
Great. I love that notion of degaslighting.
It's sad that that's a basic toolkit we need these days. It is, yeah.
Yeah, reality checks. And nothing is wasted. No one is waste, and nothing is wasted.
Absolutely. Just refusing to internalize that message any further when it's out there everywhere all the time. That is already powerful work, to just be refusing that, drawing those lines and those boundaries, to not let these really horrific framings of people and difference and diversity, just to not internalize that, is already such important work in and of itself, and being able to kind of show that to others as well.
Thank you so much, Valerie Black, for talking with us today about the eugenics logic behind running a government like a startup under the Trump administration. We will link to your article on the webpage for this segment on the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Universal health care is a human right.
Universal health care is a human right.